There's been no shortage of psychological analyses of President-elect Donald Trump, but some would say that the main thing to know about him is that he's a capitalist and, they would say, a particular kind of capitalist at that, a lumpen capitalist. Usually lumpen is a word that's associated with Karl Marx's concept of the lumpen proletariat, for those members of the working class who are really more like a criminal element who lack awareness of their collective interest as an oppressed class. Some analysts see Trump as the capitalist equivalent of that. Samuel Farber is a retired professor at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York who's written about Trump as a lumpen capitalist. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg.
Lumpen capitalists. You know, people talk about the two wings of the ruling class, the ruling elite, and one takes power and then the other takes power, and according to some sources, it doesn't make much difference. So where would you place the lumpen capitalist here, in the case of Donald Trump? Does he represent one of the wings of the ruling class, or is this something entirely different?
I think, and made this point in my article, and I bring our further today, perhaps even more. There's a number of capitalists in the energy section, for example. You can see the other capitalists are giving a tremendous amount of money to Trump, so there are certain sectors of the capitalist class that definitely support and certain individuals, for sure. But I don't think that the majority of the capitalist class supports it. We have seen, for example, that the overwhelming Kamala Harris and her campaign had much more money and spent a lot more money than Trump did. So clearly, in terms of being financed, that the Democrats were better financed and were also back in the previous elections in which one Trump won, the other one he lost, they were better. Hillary Clinton, for example, was better financed by Trump. So the question is, I think that some people on the left use a very mechanical approach to the relationship of the ruling class to certain politicians. And there are politicians that perhaps not so much in the United States, but I'll get that to you in a second, but politicians very often are outside of the capitalist class, which doesn't mean that they do not defend the capitalist class interests and do not negotiate and coordinate with them. But they are not necessarily the candidates that the capitalist class would have preferred. And I believe Trump is one of them.
And have you heard also that the economy tends to do better under Democrats? And if that's true, do you think a lot of big business people recognize that? And so that causes them to support Democrats?
Well, I think that there might be something to that. But I think one thing that the capitalists, let's look at this specific case of Trump. One of the things that capitalism treasures, especially a highly developed form of capitalism, such as the American one, is predictability. Predictability and uniformity of rules. One thing that capitalists not particularly enjoy is arbitrariness. They're perfectly fine with arbitrariness vis-a-vis the working class and other sectors of the population, but when it comes to the safety and security of their investment, they are not typically willing to take chances unless there is such a profound crisis in society, falling apart, when the question of the security cannot be taken for granted for other reasons, that in that case, and this was the case of Germany in the late 20s, early 30s, they only saw a group that was definitely external to the capitalist class that went in office as ensuring their future because the situation was desperate. That is not the case in the United States. And the United States doesn't have the deep deflationary crisis that Weimar Germany was facing in 1928 during the World Recession, the World Depression, which was the other side of the coin of the inflationary crisis that they experienced back in 1922-1923. So they went through an inflationary crisis, and then 5 years later with a deflationary crisis, which was part of the World Depression, and with a very powerful left, in some cases it's insurrectionary left, because the Communist Party was then in its ultra-left period throughout the world. So in that situation of lack of security, they are, of course, willing to support not just a Trump, but a Hitler.
What about the idea that Trump is in a way, a business failure? Does that make people at the higher levels distrust him, or is he considered in a way a success because it hasn't mattered to him that he's a failure? He manages to accumulate large amounts of money anyway and power.
Well, I think that Trump is a failure, and he isn't. Certainly, as I pointed out in my article, he had a record number of bankruptcies. I mean, this guy, the bankruptcy was in a way his business.
And it
But
hasn't
now,
seemed to matter.
yeah, but now, since I wrote the article, he developed something like Truth Social, which has been successful in business terms, that is, the social media thing. And he's peddling Bibles with that. He's a huckster. So he has made money in Hollywood, not through hotels and real estate, but hucksterism, which fits very much, in my opinion, the characterization of Lupin, because part of what characterizes the Lupin sector of society, and I will get that in a second, is this kind of flightiness, this kind of instability, this kind of here today, there tomorrow, where it's of capital and all the sector of society. So this takes Trump found other ways to hustle and make money. But he was never an important capitalist. That was a lot of make-believe that he has throughout his life. And very much influenced by Roy Cohn, who was his master. He was the guy who was responsible in great part for the execution of the Rosenberg. Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn was Trump's teacher. And therefore, part of that Lumpen outlook on the world was make believe and make believe to people that he was a super successful billionaire.
And what about the attitude of the Republican Party toward him? Do they care about that, the fact that he's a huckster?
Well, I don't think they really care. I think they are terrified of it. Right now we have a situation. We have senators from Alaska, two women from Alaska and from Maine that do not like Trump at all and are making noises as to voting if there is a chance to vote against this really useless and awful candidates for office, like for attorney general, this guy from Florida, I think it is. But the threat he has over them that has been successful is, okay, you go ahead and vote against it, then the next election you come up, we're going to primary you. And primary you means we're going to find an opponent who, given by the support I have among the right wing, is going to be pitched. And so he has successfully done that several times. So he has them terrorized. Because I doubt very much that today, and that's why he's trying to, if he wants a recent appointment so he doesn't have to get Senate approved. In fact, he's even opposed to an FBI review of this candidate. So today, I'm sure that he doesn't have a majority in the Senate. And that would be, and the same would be in January because it would be like 53 to 47. That's not enough to assure, particularly there are Republicans who would desert him. And at that point, by the way, in January, there would be no marching around the senator from West Virginia because he not only would be a senator, and also the woman from Arizona, if I don't remember his name, and then that would also would not be a senator.
Oh,
So it's
Christian Cinema, yeah.
the two Democrats that were wavering all the time. Those two are gone. So he knows very well that if he will get 47 Democrats, it will be not very difficult to find four people on Republicans that will vote against certainly at least the case of Gates. How do you pronounce it? Gaetz. I'm not even sure how to pronounce the word.
Yeah, I've heard it's Gates, yeah.
Yeah, who is that? By the way, it's another example. I don't know as much about him as I know about Trump, obviously. But a guy has all sorts of accusations. A report was about to be released in the House of Representatives about his abuse of women and all sorts of other stuff, and he resigned. So the House would no longer have jurisdiction over him, so to speak. So we're talking about a series of really incompetent, reactionary people to several positions in the government that are really disgraceful. Just think that to make Marco Rubio as the quote-unquote the left wing of the appointees, it's a joke.
And how about Mike Huckabee as ambassador to Israel?
Yeah, he's the only so-called establishment candidate that he has nominated. But why to the State Department? Because he's not afraid of the State Department. He already, when the previous time he occupied office, he dramatically cut the budget of the State Department, which incidentally is one of the reasons why with the massive cut in the State Department, why it became more difficult for them to live their past of the time. That's one of the results of that. So he's in a bind, but I do not at all trust even Democrats or Republicans to put up a fight.
So do you think he's going to be able to do what he says he's going to do in Ukraine and Gaza, just end those wars?
Very well. I wish and hope that he doesn't. Another area that I am intrigued about, because I don't have the sufficient knowledge, empirical, factual knowledge about it, is that he's making a lot of enemies in the FBI. And people in the FBI both have a lot of information on him that they could easily leak. They cannot do it at the FBI, obviously, when they could easily leak it to the press. God knows what information they have from. So that's speculation. But clearly, aside from speculation, he's alienating them too. Because he said, I do not want any FBI review of the candidate I support.
And you think he's going to go along with the Project 2025 recommendations and basically defang the regulatory agencies?
Look, Trump is an opportunist. Trump is a totally unprincipled guy, including unprincipled guy right with terms. That is, after all, he wrote the art of the deal, right? He put against the wall, he would make deals then and there. And if trying to push the whole of Project 2025, whatever it's called, is the problem. He will sideline it and choose among the proposals made in that project to see which one he's going to push forward. He has no obligation to that foundation to follow that thing to the letter, but he certainly can and will pick and choose among the proposals they make. And he's going to proceed. Remember that when he started back in 2017, his first period, in January 2017, the first thing he went for was for the undocumented worker. And the same thing is going to happen this time. But even there, he will have to be opportunistic if he's really serious about getting rid of all undocumented workers. He will have a serious economic crisis in the United States. More than half of farm workers in the United States are undocumented workers. More than half. Imagine what will happen with the orange crop in Florida, with all the crops that this magnificent state of California has, if all of a sudden they cannot count on more than half the labor force. I don't know if you and your people who listen to your program ever saw the movie A Day Without Mexican that was filmed, I don't know, 10 years ago. It is a comedy, but it's a very truthful comedy.
Well, and then you got the construction industry and the hospitality industry and the people who take care of people's children. Yeah.
Construction services, hotels, restaurants, but agriculture is very hot, the strategically most important one in the sense of immediate effects.
Yeah, and I imagine there'll be a big pushback from various business lobby groups, wouldn't you think?
Right. Right, so, but he too will be opportunistic about it. He is, which is, you know, it would take a long time to support this, but it is also a characteristic of the loopiness, if you want to call it that, of Trump. There is a book that I would recommend to you and to your listeners, which is by the historian E.J. Hobsbawm, you know, who died about 10 years ago. British, very well known historian, British historian. Now, he wrote a book, which I use in my courses very often, Primitive Rebel. And in that book, Primitive Rebel, he analyzes, historically analyzes the nature of the mafia, for example, in Italy, how it developed, so on. And then he looks at so-called revolt or revolution, but they were not revolutions at all, in which the people in power use the looping element in places like Italy, for example, Palermo, Naples in Italy, to use those elements for reactionary purpose. And when I talk about lumping, I'm not talking about lumping in the loose sense of the word. I'm trying to follow not because it's smart, but because I believe it's right on this, what is the criminal element. The lumpen doesn't mean the unemployed, doesn't mean the poor. That's slander. If people talk about this, that's the right wing that tries to demonize poor people and working people. That's not what Marx was using the term for. He was using the term against criminal elements who are for sale, politically speaking.
And the Nazis were able to recruit them as well, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the remarkable events in the history of Nazism was the night, what was called the Night of the Long Knives, which was in 1934, that Hitler was utilized to purge the so-called Red Fascists. And by that, the term it was used to mean people who took seriously, including leaders like the Strasser brothers, for example. Captain Rom, R-O-H-M,
yeah.
Who took seriously the so-called socialist ideology. Nazism is for national socialism, right?
Right.
They took seriously the socialism part of it and were, in a sense, anti-capitalist. But also, as it happened, it was had a very strong bohemian element in the leadership of that group, including, for example, something that later became absolutely invisible to Nazism, you know, a lot of it. Some of the leaders were gay. And Hitler used them to try to successfully take power. But once he was in power, at the first opportunity, which was just a year later, he wiped them out. He purged them, he killed them, and that was the end of the... And it was a looping element itself, many of these people, you know. So there's the classic example that of the Nazism using looping elements to gain power, and as soon as they had a chance, wipe them out. Because after all, Hitler was a jerk in his personal life.
Would you say there's any sort of analogy you could draw with groups like the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys, or there's something else entirely, you see?
Oh, absolutely. Those are the sorts of people, and that's why I think that it's premature, in my opinion, it's premature, because things change, to talk about Trump as a fascist. Trump is a reactionary, but I think unfortunately, there are current examples in Europe about governments like, in my opinion, the best example is the government of Hungary, which has formally retained the institutions of parliamentary democracy, but ends the end of conflict. So Hungary today, I don't think anybody in their right mind should say, well, using the word in some position, it's not just, I mean, if you would just fascism in this world, I don't have a problem. You motherfucking fascist, you know, that kind of thing, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about term fascism in some kind of systematic, rigorous way. I don't think that the government of Hungary, certainly the government of Italy, which is led by an ex-fascist woman, or for them to come to power in France, the big mass right-wing movement there, I don't think that the word fascism as based on the 30s and 40s in Germany and the 20s to 40s in Italy is the kind of system that these type of groups are aiming to. I think they're aiming to an authoritarian, anti-democratic, reactionary thing. But not all anti-democratic, totalitarian movements and systems are fascist.
Would you think that it could be what Bertram Gross called friendly fascism?
I may have even read it, but I don't think it was. And I think I did read it, but to be honest, I read it such a long time ago, I don't remember it right now.
It's kind of like you have a corporatist society, but you allow political dissent, but you make sure that they're suppressed, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I don't think that there will be anything friendly about Trump. What there will be is an unfriendly reactionary movement, which may develop into fascism, but I don't think that's what is likely to happen. But it's going to be a reactionary, a democratic, that essentially will try to deprive the American system of whatever democratic content it still has. And I say democratic content it still has because, in my view, I'm sure many people would agree with it, if you compare the United States with other capitalist democracies, you know, France, England, Germany, etc., this is the least democratic of the capitalist democracies. Look at the kind of election we have, where the Electoral College, you know, this is an archaic anti-democratic institution. The Senate is elected in a completely undemocratic way for 6 years, and Wyoming
And then they didn't even used to elect the Senate directly. It used to be selected.
So, as far as the Senate is concerned, Wyoming has two, and California has two. California has millions and millions of people. Wyoming, I think, barely has a million people or something like that. Maybe not even that.
Of course, you could say the same thing about Vermont, which is where Bernie Sanders got elected.
That is, you're absolutely right. I mean, but Bernie Sanders became a very popular guy in this country, but not because of the number of Vermonters who support him. He became a popular figure in spite of that, not because of that.
That's retired Brooklyn College professor Samuel Farber speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on January 8th, 2025.